I'm chatting this afternoon with Professor Peter McIntyre, who is the Director of the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance. Thanks for your time, Professor McIntyre.
No problem.
You've co-authored a perspective that's going into the Medical Journal of Australia shortly on immunisation rates and more specifically the effect or non-effect of the no-jab, no-play legislations around the country. The anti-vaccination lobbies get a lot of attention. Are we giving them more credit than they deserve?
Well, they certainly have a lot higher volume and a lot more media attention than their numbers deserve. That's absolutely true.
What are the vaccination rates in Australia and how do we rate globally?
How we rank globally depends a little bit on how you measure things. But what we know is that, you know, the estimates we get from the immunisation register are pretty much the minimum, because we know that there are more kids immunised than are actually all identified on the register for various reasons. And Australia's been well over the 90% mark since the early 2000s, possibly before that. And we also know that since the register underestimates by at least a couple of a percent, that we're probably, as an overall national average, we're probably pretty close to the 95% or at the 95%. But we do obviously have areas of lower coverage than that. And particularly we have sort of hotspots, which have really been the same for a long, long time. So they're kind of people, aggregations of people with certain lifestyle and views about health and so on, who are predominantly in coastal areas. And they're pretty much in every state. They're sometimes, well, in the case of, say, somewhere like Adelaide and the Adelaide Hills, it's not a coastal area, but they're all sort of alternative lifestyle type areas with strong aggregations of people with different views about health. And we don't have, unlike somewhere like the Netherlands, we don't have a Bible Belt or with a group of people who have strong religious-based views that think it's God's will if you get a disease, so you shouldn't really be doing anything about it. We don't have that, but we do have people who've got views about traditional approaches to health and healthcare, and vaccines are seen as being in that boat. And
yes,
so the most welded on group there are just convinced that vaccines are either not effective or dangerous because they've got toxins and other things, or both. And it's very difficult to shift that, what is a very small group as an overall national percentage,
yeah,
maybe 2%, but in some areas like the north coast of New South Wales and so on, that in some areas they could be as high as 20%, but that's very much the exception.
Given that the numbers of anti-vaccination or the vaccine refusal crowd is quite small, why are we so prescriptive in our punishment of them in the sense that no jab, no pay and no jab, no play are really quite punishing financially on those people?
No jab, no pay, I guess, was particularly initially driven by the fact that for the first time via the then National Health Performance Authority, which at that time, you know, was the first kind of, I guess, authorised way to make available the detailed information at postcode level. And that really spurred a lot of media coverage around, you know, areas, particularly, I guess, areas, you know, that might be considered a bit more affluent or trendy in cities,
yeah,
where these rates were said to be low and potentially a problem. And that sort of coincided, I guess, with all the concern about pertussis and pertussis deaths from young infants. And the two are not necessarily related, but they sort of got related in the media messaging around all of this. And so, you know, on the one hand, it's obviously a worthwhile aim to try and get as close to 100% of children having received their recommended vaccines as possible. But on the other hand, we have to be mindful of what, although it's important and although it certainly protects the individuals involved and also provides some measure of herd immunity to the community, that you can actually, depending on the vaccine, you can achieve that herd immunity with less than 95%. And for some diseases like measles, even 95% is not necessarily enough, because we don't have any of our own homegrown measles. You know, we've declared measles elimination from Australia, which means that any measles we get now is really coming in from elsewhere. I guess some of the notable places it's come from in the last 4 or 5 years include Thailand, the Philippines, to a lesser extent, Indonesia, etc. And we also, as well as having, as far as measles is concerned, as well as having some areas of low immunisation in pockets, we also have lots of young adults who, in their late 20s and early 30s, who sort of missed out on the measles control campaign. They were too young for that or old for that at the time. and they may have missed out on getting two doses because it wasn't happening in schools and they are around. And so we have quite a pocket of young adults who may not have received the two doses and so therefore are more vulnerable, say, a case of measles turns up from overseas. And then the other thing that's happened in relation to measles is because we've had such high immunisation rates and such low numbers of measles cases for now a long time, that means that there's not any kind of natural, inverted commas, boosting going on. And pretty much all the young mothers now who are having babies have got their measles immunity from vaccination. And by the time they've reached their 20s or 30s, their antibody levels that are transmitted to the baby may be quite low compared to what used to happen when mothers had measles acquired from natural infection. And I'm not saying we should go back, but it means that we have this sort of immunity gap with measles where in a lot of cases the antibody levels may have gone down to well below protective by 6 months of age, and then of course you don't get your first dose till 12 months. So a characteristic of the last couple of episodes we've had of an introduction from, say, Thailand, which was what happened with the big New South Wales outbreak with a couple of hundred cases back in 2012, that in fact the biggest single group or the highest incidents in that outbreak were actually babies under 12 months, between 6 and 12 months, because they would potentially encounter an infectious case in, you know, let's say a medical centre or emergency department or something like that and not have antibody. And so that's been a change. And then the other biggest group are the sort of teenagers and young adults who either may have come from overseas and not received their vaccinations here in their younger childhood and then not being checked on later on, or young adults who missed out for some reason. And so we've sort of got that kind of 15 to about 35 group at the one end, and we've got the under 6 to 12 months at the other with measles now. And that, of course, is only when we have these introductions from overseas. We have maintained, unlike countries in Europe, where Britain had eliminated measles before the Andrew Wakefield stuff, and they're still playing catch-up now. And yeah, Fortunately, we were able to dodge that bullet, and we've continued to maintain our no homegrown measles, you know, right through. And there's no doubt that if there's an introduction, you know, the more people that have had their two doses, the better for everyone. And so there's definitely a benefit. But, you know, even if you've had two doses, 1% of people may not have protective antibody, and then you've got the people who missed out for some reason. So we've still got the potential for measles outbreaks to kind of smoulder on a bit, because measles are sort of a bit like a heat-guided missile. You know, it will just seek and find, you know, people whose immunity is not sufficient, yeah, you know, in any... It's really good at doing that.
Do we know what the rate of conscientious objection to vaccination is?
I guess there's two main groups there. There's been the, for some time now, there was the capacity to sign up as a conscientious objector to be formally registered, which involves having had some sort of counselling or, you know, meeting with a health professional to document that. And the proportion of people doing that did go up from 0.2% to 1.8%, but we think that's actually an increase in people signing up rather than an increase in the number of people who actually had views like that. And as the requirement and the amount of money involved for the benefits that were linked to immunisation has increased, and particularly there was a big increase in about 2011-12 when the full amount of the childcare benefit and so on was added, that we've had a bigger incentive for people to sign up. But if you look at the estimates from back in about 2001, based on people who probably are objectors but aren't officially signed up versus those who are, the total still comes to around 3%. So they're more visible, and there's been a big increase in the number who are actually registered. But probably the total numbers are around the same. And of course, some of those people are not people who are not having any vaccines. They're people who, for one reason or another, don't want to have a particular vaccine or a particular couple of vaccines, but have had the others.
Right.
So even amongst the objectors or refusers, it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And there certainly are some people who may have been registered as conscientious objectors in the past to be eligible for benefits, but in fact have had a number of vaccines. They just haven't had all of them.
So in terms of no jab, no pay or play, are those pieces of legislation keeping babies safe?
Well, I think that as there've been a couple of ministerial press releases, you know, talking about the number of additional children who were, you know, retained their eligibility for benefits by updating their immunisation. And that figure, of course, includes the expanded reach of no jab, no pay, which came with the legislation. And that was a really big development.
Yeah.
Instead of only looking at your status on the ACIR, which was up to the age of 7, the no jab, no pay legislation expanded it to the age of 19. And that potentially may turn out to be the biggest impact of no jab, no pay, the fact that there was this big extension where all of a sudden, you know, older children and teenagers in high school but not working, that the family suddenly discovered that they were no longer eligible for the benefits. And that we do know anecdotally that that prompted a big upsurge in people seeking catch-up vaccines. And I think both GPs and other clinics found that. And so that is probably, could well turn out to be, you know, the major impact of no jab, no pay. And obviously one of the things we're saying in the paper is that it's terribly important to evaluate this carefully, because it's an internationally unique initiative. It's something that is sort of particularly Australian in the sense that we did have these additional family benefits over and above standard social security, which doesn't necessarily apply in other comparable countries. So there was a bit more scope to target those benefits. But we've also gone down that track of linking the benefit eligibility to completing an immunisation. And there's no doubt that that does nudge people into getting things done, which maybe otherwise they hadn't got around to, et cetera. And in some cases, there might be people who actually they've got a lot of concerns and issues, but maybe they'd rather not do it otherwise, but it just sort of gets them over the line to do it. So there's no doubt it's doing things and has done things. But it's also clear that if you're in that rusted on, I've never seen the vaccine I liked kind of group, that it's not going to cut the mustard there. And I guess there was a concern with no jab, no pay that, you know, if you were in a less advantaged family, and that's another myth about objectors or refusers, that they're all people who very kind of privileged socioeconomic group and are just rejecting things for ill-informed reasons. But actually, there are less people who are in less advantaged circumstances, probably a 2-to-1 difference. But there are people there who are just worried, concerned about, or just fearful about some aspects of vaccines and for whom the dollars are really important. And that could mean that a child who would otherwise benefit from early childhood education in childcare or preschool misses out. And so I suppose you've always got to trade off. And that's why we think the evaluation is really important. You've got to trade off what are the good things in terms of raising immunisation coverage, nudging people along, enhancing individual and community protection against the bad things, because we know that a child missing out on early childhood educational opportunities, we know that that is really bad in terms of, you know, your subsequent educational progression. And I think that really kicks in when we get to talking about no jab, no play, which wasn't really the primary focus of the paper, because it was written, maybe 6 or 9 months ago. But no jab, no play, particularly if it applies to preschools, you've really got to ask yourself how much extra that's doing over and above what is already in place. Because firstly, immunised kids in preschools, I mean, they're all over 3, and they should have all had their 2 doses of MMR. They should have had all their other vaccines that they're due for. And so even if you did get an introduction of something, you know, like measles in a childcare like that, it actually isn't a risk to those fully immunised kids who are in the childcare. It's a little bit of a myth that there are these terrible disease risks that other children, you know, who are in the childcare would be exposed to from an unimmunised child. And, of course, childcare in general is just like infection and getting infections. It's a fantastic way to do that. You know, you've suddenly gone to this really big family. Obviously, you can pick up a whole range of things. And in fact, hopefully, given our really good performance with immunisation, hopefully only a very small number of those would be vaccine preventable. And one of the things, though, that the no jab, no play approach in somewhere like New South Wales, which really made documentation compulsory. So the childcare centres had to know exactly who was immunised, who wasn't. And if you've got that information and it's up to date and well maintained, then you can obviously take appropriate action. If there is a case of a vaccine preventable disease in the centre, you can insist on children who aren't fully vaccinated being excluded. And so you've got that's a powerful piece of reassurance for people, I think. But that it is a bit of a myth that there's this terrible disease risk that other children or other parents, you know, doing the right thing, in inverted commas, are exposed to by these unimmunised children, particularly when you're talking about, you know, older kids in preschool. And conversely, with an older kid in preschool, that's when you're really missing out on your kickstart for school, you know, if you're excluded from participating in that. So that kind of cost benefit thing becomes a much more focused question. And it really, in a sense, it sort of flips the focus to something like pertussis, where we know that because pertussis vaccines, they're certainly worthwhile and they're good at protecting young children against severe pertussis, but we also know that they're not that great against mild pertussis, you know, getting a bit of a cough,
and they do
wear off. And so even with 100% of kids getting immunised about pertussis, unfortunately, still circulates in the community, unlike measles. And until we get a pertussis vaccine that's up there with measles with a, you know, 95% effectiveness or something, we're going to continue to see that, you know, the pertussis will continue to circulate, even though it's got, you know, high immunisation rates. And so the solution to that is maternal immunisation, which is the way of bridging that gap, the gap between a child being born and having had its first one or two vaccines, after which the protection against severe disease is pretty good. But there's that gap of 2 or 3 months before that's happened, where the only way to protect those really young babies, who are the ones that, of course, get sick and the ones that die, the only way to protect them is for the mothers to be receiving vaccine in pregnancy. And so I think if we're really keen on preventing the cases of severe disease, if that's our primary aim, then it makes much more sense to be going hard on promoting, supporting maternal immunisation as much as we can, both at the general practice level and in hospitals and other places. And that's the way to protect the really little babies, the babies who virtually never be attending a childcare centre and certainly not a preschool. If you want to protect them, then that's our approach. That's what we need to be emphasising. I mean, the main concern was, and hopefully this is not the case among the medical audience, but this still this view out there in sort of general public land or, you know, the pub test or whatever, firstly, that we've actually got much lower immunisation rates than we do, and they're actually very high and they've been high for a long time. And secondly, that there's lots more conscientious objectors than there are and they're going up all the time, which they're not. And thirdly, that unimmunised children in a childcare centre or a preschool pose a huge risk to fully immunised children, which unless you've got a fully immunised child who happens to have some bad disease like, you know, leukemia or something, in which case they're probably very unlikely to be attending a regular preschool. But unless you've got children like that, then basically everyone else, they're really not at risk. They're at risk of all kinds of other infections that circulate in childcare, including, you know, influenza, obviously. Another one we'd like to see, you know, the influenza vaccine rates, improve. But they're not, you know, they're not going to be getting measles. They're not going to be getting meningitis from HIB.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Kate.